This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. For more than 40 years, scientists around the world have had a problem. Well, maybe it's more accurate to say they've been on a search to solve a problem. See, back in the 1960s, a man named Peter Higgs was among those who figured out that the standard model of physics would work only if a minute particle no one had ever before seen actually existed. But that particle must exist, most physicists came to believe, if reality really worked the way science thought it did. Name for that guy, Peter? Physicists began to figure out that if the Higgs particle did exist, then someone ought to be able to find it. If this sounds familiar, maybe it's because of recent news from the world's biggest super collider, where a new particle that might just be the long-sought Higgs has now been sighted. So just how big a deal is this, and what might it mean for the future of science? Two Virginia researchers instrumental in the new finding will be here to tell us right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Got a question about the mysterious, all-important particle known as the Higgs boson? Got a theory about the nature of reality that you think is, or is not, currently explained by science in the world of physics? Then this would be a really good time to mark down our phone number. 888-WMRA-TALK. Also known as 888-967-2825. Here in the Insight Studio, two specialists in high-energy physics, both on the faculty of the Physics Department at the University of Virginia, and both extensively involved in the work at the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland. Brad Cox and Christopher New, welcome back to the Insight Studios.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
So where are we in the search for the Higgs particle? And by the way, just what is the Higgs?
Well, this is a long story, and we'll try to get 115 years of experimentation tied down for you, Tom, here in the next hour. In 1897, the first fundamental particle that we know of was discovered. It was the electron, the thing that comes out of your wall socket. In the subsequent 100 years, we filled out a periodic table of elementary particles, as we call them. And this now includes 16 particles. And these particles, unfortunately, it was a bit embarrassing for the theorist, these particles only worked in a theory where there was no mass. And this was true until 1962, when Peter Higgs, a English theorist, elementary particle theorist, had the idea of the Higgs mechanism, or the Higgs particle, as he called it. And that particle is the particle that gives mass to everything in the universe by its interaction with these fundamental particles, the electrons, the quarks, the leptons, as we call them. Now, if you want to think about what's going on here, the Higgs particle suffuses all of nature, everywhere in the universe. You're moving through a sea of these Higgs particles. As some British physicist said, it's like moving through treacle, molasses for us U.S. Folks. So you're walking through molasses. You're being given inertia or mass, as its equivalent is, and this is the way that the Higgs particle actually functions.
So I think one of the things I'd
this
add...
This is Chris New.
One of the things I'd add to what Brad's saying is that he kind of undersold a little bit of the last 120 years of particle physics, in that we've developed over the last many decades this really, really accurate model of the fundamental universe. And so as scientists, you know, it's our job to understand how the world works. That's what we do. As particle physicists, we're trying to understand the tiny building blocks of the universe and how the characteristics of those building blocks and how those building blocks interact. And over the last, 40 years, we've developed an exquisite model. This model is one of the triumphs of modern physics, modern science, in that it makes a whole host of predictions, predictions in the everyday world for how electricity moves through a circuit or how light propagates in this room. It makes predictions on the tiniest scales on how, radioactive nuclei decay, predictions on the grand scale of the universe, high energy cosmic rays, things like this, we can understand in the context of this highly successful model. But even though this thing was such a triumph, it had some problems. And one of the problems was this inability for the model to accommodate the masses of the fundamental particles. And, it was kind of unsatisfying. We had this model was very good. It helped us as scientists understand the world that we live in, but it was missing this essential piece of information, and that was, why do the particles have mass? Inside the model, they were allowed to mathematically be massless, and all of these predictions would still be borne out. But we know, when we look around us, it's manifestly true that the particles do indeed have mass. And so our job wasn't done, even though we had this very nice model that was very successful. There was still more work that needed to be done.
To the degree that we would not have the existence of much of the technology that we have in the world today if you were not able to make the kinds of predictions that you are able to make about how electrons and protons and quarks all work.
Yeah, this was all this was fundamental science. I mean, see, people talk about the difference between basic research and applied research. Well, it just is looking at it at different timescales. I mean, every piece of applied research was basic science at some point, basic research. And so we are basically the world we are today because of the advances that we've made in fundamental science. This is one field of fundamental science. It had a significant contribution to modern society in terms of technologies and things like that. The understanding that we're looking for is really basic science, basic understanding on how the universe works. And although we had this very successful model, it was still unsatisfactory because it had this gaping hole in our understanding. There are some others that we're still looking at, but this is the primary one. It was the one that I would say is, and some people might argue with me, is this is one of the most important questions in modern physics.
This is the profound discovery. These other elementary particles that we have laboriously built up into a periodic table, this is the one that sits at the center of the action, as it were. It gives mass to all these other particles and gives mass to everything that we know about.
Under this theory, developed by the British scientist Peter Higgs and others.
Peter Higgs and others, and I should emphasize that it's 1962 to now, which is 50 years, and it's taken 50 years of experimentation to show that this wonderful fairy tale has actually got some chance of being really true.
So Brad Cox from the University of Virginia, and very much a part of the experimentation going on at CERN and the supercollider there. If I understand what you and your colleague, Chris New, have been saying, the Higgs particle is assumed to exist. If it does exist, in fact, it helps explain what gives other basic particles mass. And I'll ask you more about that in a moment. And our listeners are certainly welcome to get in on this discussion at any time at 888-WMRA Talk. If you listen for very long, you'll be able to tell that the host of this show doesn't know much about physics and can use as much help as possible. So if you listening want to help, the number is 888-967-2825. But Brad Cox, there are two things here I want to double check with you. One is that this is a theory, even still today, even though you think you might have seen something that could be the Higgs.
Correct.
It is a theory that for 50 years has been perhaps the most popular theory about this missing link of how reality works.
Well, there were a set of experiments and additional theoretical work after the Higgs idea that actually fleshed out this story, the storyboard for this 50 years. And as we got more and more data of different types, indirect, not an observation of the Higgs per se, but indirect evidence, we became confident that this was probably going to work. So the intention of every new accelerator, every new collider after a while, was that we would look for this particle, see if we could make the particle, because these particles that exist everywhere in the universe are not immediately apparent to us. We have to generate a lot of energy by colliding protons together to make these particles real so that we can see them. And that's
so Chris,
what we've done.
At CERN, at the super collider on the border between Switzerland and France, near outside Geneva, recently something happened, and there was an announcement on the 4th of July of this year saying, we saw something that could be the Higgs.
Yes.
How likely is it that it was the Higgs, and when will you know for sure?
So it is very likely that it is a particle that behaves as the Higgs boson is expected to. Now this might sound like I'm waffling a little bit, but it's really true that there is this theory by Higgs. It allows for this new particle. There are small variations on that theme allow for a Higgs boson with slightly different characteristics. Maybe it couples to other, or it decays to other particles in different manners than the one that we most expect. So what we have seen, and there's many different small variations on this theme. What we have identified is a new particle with a mass. It itself did not have a prediction for its mass, but other pieces of evidence would tell us what the most probable mass would be. We have found a particle that is consistent with that most probable mass. But when we look at how it decays to other particles, other very common particles that we deal with every day in our experiments, we look at those decay rates. We don't see it decaying in exactly the way that we would have expected the most popular Higgs candidate or Higgs predicted Higgs to behave. And so what we're seeing here is a new particle consistent with a Higgs-like object whose complete characteristics still need to be mapped out in order for us to understand what exactly this Higgs-like particle is.
It's still early days. We have about half of the data that we thought we would need to actually pin down this particle. There are some significant characteristics that are more subtle than just the observation of the particle that we have to measure before we can actually say it's for the Higgs itself, as opposed to one of a number of Higgs particles.
Experimental particle physicists Chris New and Brad Cox are with us on this edition of Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. 888-WMRA Talk is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, if you want to post a question or comment, on Facebook we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. First to the phone lines, Harrisonburg, it's Corey, I believe, that's calling us. Corey, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. My question is if the Higgs boson works as sort of like a field in which gives all other things mass, how does that kind of relate to particles which reportedly have no mass, such as neutrinos?
That is a good
this
question, and in fact, the standard model of particle physics actually has this explanation embedded in it. For example, the photon has zero mass, but that's a prediction of the standard model and including the Higgs mechanism in the standard model. So it's a rather beautiful thing that you can actually have these things all come together. And by the way, the neutrino may have mass. We're still trying to measure this. But the photon doesn't have mass, but that's perfectly natural within the context of what we call the standard model that Chris was talking about earlier.
Yeah, this standard model, one of the details that I glossed over is that so in the physical world, there are four forces. Okay, this standard model that we're talking about, this great triumph of science, accommodates really only three of them. But one of the nice things is that it links two of them into a unified model.
Not everybody might remember what the four forces are.
Okay, why don't we get into that?
So when we get back from the break, would you be willing to tell us?
Absolutely.
And Corey, we have to break for just a bit more than 1 minute. Can you hang on that long in case you have a follow-up?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to continue our discussion here about the search for the Higgs particle with two scientists who are part of that search. And if you have a question for us, you're welcome to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Experimental particle physicists Chris New and Brad Cox are our guests here on Virginia Insight. Both of these scientists are members of the High Energy Physics Group at the University of Virginia. Both have a long association with the celebrated Fermi Lab outside Chicago, and both are members of a team of scientists from around the world who've been searching for a new understanding of the nature of reality through the work they're doing at the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland. And we still have Corey on the line. Chris New, you were in the middle of your response to Corey's question about neutrinos.
Okay, so let's. Well, this one's more about the photon, but that's fine. So one of the nicest features of this standard model, this very successful model that we have, is that it accommodates three of the known forces in the world. Tom, you know what the four forces are. What's the one that's most familiar to you?
Gravity.
Gravity. What's the second most familiar one to you? Are the lights
magnetism,
running?
Magnetism, electromagnetism.
Electromagnetism. Okay, and then there's two other ones that I don't expect you to remember.
But you were here 2 years ago, so I might.
Okay, fair enough.
There's something about nuclear forces. Is there weak nuclear force?
Weak nuclear force and the?
Strong?
Very good. So there are four forces, strong, weak, electromagnetism, and gravity.
Look at that. I actually know something about
physics. That was very good.
Congratulations.
So the standard model does a great job in that it accommodates three of those forces. Not the fourth one. Gravity is so weak that we don't even, in the things that we deal with, it's just not even a part, needs to be a part of our mathematical model. It's fine. But one of the really elegant parts of this model is that we can take two of those forces, the mathematical description of those two, and link them together in I'm going to use a mathematical word here, but it doesn't matter, a symmetric way. Okay, and so the mathematics of those two interactions ends up being conjoined. Okay, and that's really nice because one of the things as scientists is that not only do we want to understand the world, but we also want to understand it in the simplest way possible. So if I can understand three things with only really developing two models the mathematics of two models inside my standard model, then that's good because it's one less thing I've got to remember. The thing is about this electroweak symmetry, it's the linking of the electromagnetic and the weak forces, so we call it electroweak symmetry. The thing is that the mathematics allow for the force carriers. So remember we talk about little bits of matter and how they interact. Those interactions are, in the mathematics, conveyed by the exchange of other particles, these force-carrying bosons. In the mathematics of this electroweak symmetry, the masses of the force carriers for electromagnetism and the weak force, which are respectively the photon and the W and Z boson, doesn't really matter what they are, but there's just two different types, those are allowed to be the same mass or massless. But we know that the photon has no mass. That's just something we know because light, photon is light, travels at the speed of
light.
Very good. But we know that the W and Z have non-zero masses. And so this is actually Corey's question about the photon remaining massless. That's actually built in. That's a prerequisite for the Higgs mechanism. That's the thing that we needed to solve, actually, is why the photon remains massless and the W and Z, they're just names, but these other force carriers are massive. That's this thing.
That's the triumph of the theory.
That
actually embeds the Higgs boson into an early result when we had observed the W and Z particles in the middle 80s. We then thought that this Higgs mechanism had some substance to it because it predicted that the W and Zs were massive and the photon was massless. That's hard to do.
In the nomenclature of the, if you're reading science magazines, this is the thing we call electroweak symmetry breaking, because the mathematics allows these things to be completely symmetric, completely massless. But we know in our world that this symmetry is broken, and it's the agent of that breaking of the symmetry in the mathematics of the model that we've been looking for 50 years.
If you could see the underlying symmetry, you'd see a lot of zero-mass particles. But the Higgs mechanism breaks the symmetry, so the world we see is very confusing to us because these particles have mass, but we can't see the basic underlying theory. We have to infer it from the theory predicting the masses and other predictions.
So Corey in Harrisonburg, did your question get answered?
Yes, it did. That was very, very insightful.
Thank you so much for asking it, because I certainly never would have thought of it. Anybody else listening who has a question or a theory or a comment about anything to do with physics, the search for better understanding of the nature of reality, and this whole thing called the Higgs boson theory? We'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA. Talk 888-967-2825 is the same number in all numbers. And on Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Sid wrote to us on Facebook. Thank you for doing that, Sid. He says, I somewhat understand the explanations on how the Higgs boson can cause photons to obtain mass, but how does the Higgs boson itself get mass? I read on one of the science webpages that it weighs about 120 times a hydrogen atom. Okay, now I'm going to see if I've been following what you, Chris New, and you, Brad Cox, were just saying. If I'm following, Sid actually got the first part of his question wrong?
That's correct,
Dave. Because he talked about photons having mass, and you just said
it's massless.
The Higgs theory shows why it doesn't.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the second part of his question, how does the Higgs boson itself get its mass?
Yes, that's a very good question. The Higgs boson is unlike any other particle that we have in nature. It gives mass to other particles, but it gets its own mass from self-interactions. It's what we call a scalar particle. The fundamental particles that we've been building up since 1897 are essentially what we call fermions, which are spin one-half particles. Spin zero particles are not known in nature, and this Higgs particle is the first fundamental scalar that we've actually detected. Fundamental scalars have the property that they can have self-interactions which produce their mass. And this leads to another thing. The Higgs particle would blow up to an enormous mass unless there's something else out there beyond the Higgs particle. There must be things, and we give them one of the options is a whole theory called supersymmetry. Those supersymmetric particles act in a way to help cancel some of the self-interaction of the Higgs particle and keeps the Higgs particle light. The Higgs particle, even though it's 130 times the mass of the proton, is light. And the fact that it is light gives us really confidence that there's more out there beyond the Higgs that we still have to see.
Okay, so I got to ask this question, even though I have a suspicion that there really isn't an answer that most non-scientists will understand. When you talk about mass, and in fact, the whole idea that the Higgs provides a theory for how other particles end up having mass, you're not talking about weight, are you? Most of us, I think, who are not scientists, think that that if I've gained weight, I've become more massive, and that's my mass. The mass that you're talking about is something completely different?
Yeah, so weight is a scientific term as well, but it's something different. And so weight is a measure of the strength of a gravitational force on some mass, on some massive object, okay? Mass is it's a difficult thing to describe because
like
we don't—
Like you, Tom. So massive.
Yeah, because I'm so massive or because I'm so difficult to describe?
No, you're massive. Gravity is working on you.
I think gravity is working on all of us.
I'm
but
afraid
the
so.
it's mass is more of it's a difficult thing to describe because we can't step on a scale and say how much mass do I have. We can do balances and we can do that kind of stuff in a chemistry lab. It's really a characteristic of in this case when we talk about particles, it's something that's a characteristic of the particles.
You said a few moments ago that photons you would expect not to have mass because light travels at the speed of light. Did I get that right?
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes.
So if that doesn't have mass, does that help us understand what mass is?
It's related. I mean, there are, we could say that massive objects will never travel at the speed of light. We could say that you know, the concept of a mass of something is not just the masses of each of its little constituents. Okay, and so let's think about this table right here. This table has a mass. I could go get a some balance and figure out what its mass is in say kilograms or something like that. The point is, though, that this table is made up of particles, but then it's also made up of energy. You might not think of this table as being made up of energy, but it is. And so that mass, the mass that we have in this object here, is actually the sum of the masses of the particles that it's made of, but also the energy that is stored in the interaction among those particles.
Is mass a substance as opposed to a measurement of energy?
Well, mass and energy are equivalent by E=mc².
That's so our favorite one, right, Tom?
When you look at yourself, you're mostly force fields in between these fundamental entities that we call fundamental particles. So if I look at you, you're mainly a force field.
You're mainly energy, Tom.
You're mainly energy. So, but this energy has the attribute of mass by E=mc². So, you know, just to relax and enjoy the fact that
enjoy being a bundle of energy.
So that's right.
888-WMRA Talk, 888-967-2825. If you want to talk with our internationally acclaimed physicists, Brad Cox and Chris New. Charlotte in Afton, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling because I'm curious. I just would like some feedback regarding your guest's take on the work of Nassim Harriman and what he's brought to the field.
Charlotte, we have puzzled looks on our physicists' faces. So my guess is that the scientist you just mentioned does not work in the same field they do. Can you spell the name of the person that you're talking about?
The first name I believe is, well, golly, I can go look it up, but I think it's Harriman. I might be terribly mispronouncing his name.
And how did you think that was pronounced?
I've always said Harriman, Harriman, and the first name is Nassim, Nassim.
And is this someone from India?
He was born in Switzerland and presently, I believe still presently, is in Hawaii, but it's been a while since I've followed his work.
I'm sorry, Charlotte. I don't know this.
Can you describe his work, and maybe we will help us to place it.
Or a particular book that he's written?
Well, I guess you would call it a DVD, but it's also he did a work called The Black Hole, spelled W-H-O-L-E, and connecting the work of Einstein with a lot of other. See, I'm not really good at.
So, Charlotte, let me make a guess here. Is this somebody who is of the belief that there are certain aspects of physics that explain certain aspects of spirituality?
Yes, you could say that. He's connecting the dots between lots of different belief systems and lots of different theories.
Okay.
And that was what was so interesting about his work, is it was a breakthrough connecting the dots of so many disparate beliefs.
Well, you've got us all intrigued. This is not apparently a physicist who does work related to the kind of particle physics that our two guests do in high energy physics and the work that they're doing with the super collider. But thank you for mentioning the name of another theorist. And many of us will be looking in to see if we can find out more about him. Thank you so much. Chris New and Brad Cox, we've asked you before about your views on those who say there are certain aspects of quantum physics that can be used to explain certain aspects of spiritual philosophy. But let's get into that.
Well, that's a bit afield from what we normally think about, because I actually always have had the philosophy that science, as I practice it, as I know it, is establishing facts. Once you have established a fact by experimentation, you have to do an experiment, and you have to repeat the experiment, and the fact becomes a fact. It often is repeated many times. So at that point, your spirituality or your belief system should accommodate that, and I've never seen any particular problem with an accommodation being reached, because after all, we're just defining the physical world, and the beauty of the physical world becomes enhanced, if anything, that we find these beautiful way that nature works. The prediction of the mass of the W and the Z and the zero mass of the photon, that's just sweet. That is something that was awfully hard to understand. And that it is actually now a fact is a remarkable thing. And, you know, if you want my version of spirituality, there you go. It's just good.
I think, so for me, it's trying to, the thing that is most dear to me in this is trying to understand, get as close to the truth as possible in terms of how our universe works. And we do this in using the language of mathematics. We do this in using the language of science. I think that whatever God you or anyone else believes in, we would be doing asking the kind of questions that God would be supporting. You know, that being would want us to be curious. Well, and to go off and try to find out how this universe works. And so for me, similar to Brad, what I take away most, what I care about most is understanding the nature of the fundamental world and how our universe works.
Well, let's get some more understanding about just what's been going on at CERN and this super collider, especially because I think we get to talk about big explosions. In terms of what you've been doing to find this particle that may be the Higgs,
right. Okay. So we take some mundane particles. So you're made of basically everything around you is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Okay. In our periodic table of fundamental particles, the proton and neutron don't appear because they are actually made up of these things called quarks. Okay. And so primarily what we're made up of are up and down quarks, which make up protons and neutrons and electrons. So we take these mundane particles, these protons that we can get anywhere. We go to the store and get a bottle of hydrogen gas. It's basically just protons. And we can inject them into the LHC and ramp them up to a very high energy.
The LHC is the Large
Hadron Collider. So this is this... It's this huge machine, one of the largest scientific instruments ever built. It's 100 meters underground, and it's 27 kilometers in circumference.
That's like
17, 18 miles. And so we ramp these protons up to
They're
high
going
energy.
Really, really fast.
Really, really
and
fast.
We have
and
to
I'm getting
really,
ready.
Really fast. Just pause for the break.
And the best part's coming.
Cox, professor of physics, Chris New, assistant professor of physics, both from the University of Virginia, are our guests. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. You want to keep going,
so
Dr. New?
The best part is coming up. So we take these protons and we put them in this circular ring, 100 meters below ground, below the French-Swiss border, and they're in a series of magnets, 17 miles in circumference. One stream of protons going counterclockwise, the other one going clockwise. And then 40 million times a second, we smash them together. And we do this. We take these very, very energetic particle collisions and we harness that energy that's released in those collisions in the hopes of making new forms of matter. And we do this 40 million times a second, because the things that we want to look for are very rare. Even in those collisions of mundane particles, we're looking at things that happen very, very rarely. So we need to record and examine a large number of collisions to see something really exotic like a Higgs boson.
Tell me a little bit, if you could, about what happens when you collide these particles. Do they break into something even smaller? Do they cause some sort of chain reaction that creates something else?
What we're trying to do with those particles, the proton is very tiny, 10 to minus 13 centimeters. In that little region of space-time, we're replicating the environment of the early universe. So what comes out of those interactions is this zoo of particles, these fundamental particles that we're talking about. The quarks and the leptons come out of these interactions. We then look at them in this very elegant experiment called the compact muon solenoid. Not a great name, but it's a beautiful experiment in spite of it. And so, as Chris was saying, we have a billion interactions per second, on order of a billion interactions per second. We only keep a very few of those percentage-wise, because the things we're looking for the very rarest of things. The Higgs is a very rare thing to happen. So we have to be smart and actually be very selective so that we only write down, record interactions that are of interest. So we have 100 million channels of electronics in our experiment, 100 million. When we're running full tilt, we exceed all the telecoms in the world. So that's an impressive feat in and of itself.
One of the things I like to think about is that these particles that we're making in these high-energy proton collisions, they haven't been commonly available since a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And we're making them every 25 nanoseconds, 40 million times a second. So it's almost like we're going on a time machine, 40 million times a second, back to a fraction of a moment after the Big Bang. Now, that's cool. That's pretty cool. I mean, when I get to look at the data that we record, and it comes in some very mundane file format, and it's, we have problems compiling our code, or, all the logistics of having to go to CERN and do our work. It's not... It sometimes has its challenges, but then I think sometimes, well, look at the privilege that I have. I get to do this kind of science that does this incredibly cool thing. I mean, it's hard for me to put it. There's many words I could use, but it's just something that we are very lucky to be able to do what we do.
And it's very inexpensive too.
Next to Stanton, Ray. Thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for physicists Brad Cox and Chris New, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question, I don't want to sound like I'm playing the devil's advocate to theoretical science, but my question was, do physicists foresee any practical application in the discovery or the thoughtful discovery of the Higgs boson, or in more generally in the work going on at CERN as a whole?
That's a great question, Ray. We're having a little bit of problem with your cell, so if you'd be willing to hang up and listen to the response on air, I'm going to ask Brad and Chris to respond.
Okay. So, Ray, I presume that you've heard of the World Wide Web. So this is an example of a civilization-changing technology. I might be puffing it out a bit too much, but it's something that is used globally that was born out of a need that physicists like Brad and I had in the 90s to be able to communicate and share data across the oceans. And so, in fact, the World Wide Web was born at CERN to allow communication between physicists on different continents. At the time...
Actually, the very first website was the horrible CERNets, which were four ladies at CERN who worked at CERN who formed a group, a singing group, and you can go and find that on the web. That's the very first website of the billions of websites now.
So what you're talking about is a byproduct, is that you did not create the World Wide Web so that it could be used the way it's ended up being used around the world today. It was created to meet a need in making progress on this project.
Just like our superconducting magnets, just like our radiation-hard photodetectors, just like our
fast electronics,
like our broadband networks that we've developed just so that we can push data across the oceans, just like a complete grid of active computing that has populated the entire world.
That's worth focusing on, because was really the next step beyond the web, which is just for data transfer.
Let me just double check of something, Brad, that Chris New just said. I think the kind of magnetic resonance technology that was developed at CERN is something that today has applications in medicine.
Huge amount of overlaps in the medical industry. Not only the development of magnets, low-cost magnets that are reliable, but then also the detection schemes that are used when you go in and have a full body scan in some sort of cancer treatment.
So in your view, it's not too much to say that there are people alive today because of medical technology that was made possible as a result of the research at CERN.
Oh, I think that is patently true, but I think that there are many technicians and engineers and basic scientists that can make that same claim.
So the other thing that Roy was asking was, in addition to these kinds of byproducts, is there something in terms of, if you find the Higgs, a practical application that you can see eventually in the everyday world from having found it?
I'm not sure that we always hark back to the middle of the 19th century, and we have these people in England, Faraday, and others that were playing with magnetism, electricity, and magnetism. And who could have foreseen the world-changing applications of those? That may not happen with the Higgs particle, but the knowledge that you have is 50 years out. It's unseeable what actually consequences are. We don't have any crystal balls about that.
You could take that question and you could say, what is the practical application of these Higgs bosons? And now go back in time many decades to when X-rays were first discovered. That same question was asked. What good will these things that you're calling X-rays do? Now with the power of hindsight, we know that those had a profound impact on all of our lives. But at the time, no one had any idea of how they could be used. I am not going to sit here and say that the Higgs boson is going to have a profound impact on people's health and well-being the way that X-rays did. But all I can say is that it takes generations, potentially, to understand the breakthroughs that we make in fundamental research today.
I think
so. Let's talk a little bit more about another kind of byproduct, if we could. It's my understanding that the estimates out of CERN were that the economy of the area around it, in that part of Switzerland and that part of France where it is located, would benefit tremendously. Something like in the first 5 years, that it would return $3 for every dollar that had been invested in creating this huge scientific, many billion dollar experiment.
That was their study. I'm not sure.
And over many years, it's going to have a far greater economic impact. And Brad, this is something that we ought to direct at you. You're a little bit older than Chris. You've been working on this a little bit longer. So you certainly remember a little town outside Waco, Texas, where at one time the United States looked like it was going to have by far the world's biggest super collider. And if it had come to fruition, it would have come to fruition sooner than what's going on at CERN, and it would have been much bigger and more powerful than what's going on at CERN. What happened?
Well, I think I don't want to go into the political issues that caused this. There was a gradual increase in costs, not a gradual increase, a step function increase in costs because of a redesign of the magnet program. But I think what people don't realize is that we had carefully constructed the building of that machine so that all 50 states had a piece of the pie. Here in Virginia, we would have developed valves and plumbing for the cryogenic system in Lynchburg, and it would have been a boon for the economy, and things would have grown out of that.
So this was commonly thought of back in the late 1980s as the Texas Super Collider. Is that?
That's correct. Yes.
And in 1993, Congress said it's becoming too expensive. It's not worth it.
That's right.
And so they cut off funding.
The cost of it at that time was $10 or $11 billion, which is roughly the cost of the present LHC, Large Hadron Collider.
If Congress had not cut off the funding when it did, do you have a sense of one, when that super collider that's even bigger than CERN would have gone online, and how long after that you would have made the kinds of scientific advances that you're just now making in Switzerland?
Well, I think we probably would have been able to have done it in a previous millennium and not in this millennium.
The scientific advances that you're making today, you think would have been made sometime in the late 1990s, more than 10 years.
Or the early 2000s.
And there's no question in your mind that there would have been tremendous economic benefit to the U.S., just as we're now seeing in Switzerland?
That's always been the case. I hark back because I was in the early days of Fermi National Accelerator Lab, and surrounding the laboratory in the early days were cornfields, and now surrounding the laboratory are lots of high-tech firms. And it's just the way the world works. If you build something, you can always find other uses for it if you develop some technology, and the laboratories are very good at doing that, because doing a hard thing for the sake of doing a hard thing may sound like sort of stupid, but that is where your technology comes from often.
And Chris, your work at CERN in Switzerland with the Super Collider has brought you in contact with scientists from around the world?
Oh yes. Yes. So on CMS alone, we have
Solenoid.
Yeah, so the experiment's name is Compact Muon Solenoid, and so that's just the name for the experiment. On the experiment, we have upwards of 3,000 physicists
and engineers and
PhD students from something like 48 countries. And so we collaborate the way science should work. We collaborate across borders. We collaborate classical enemies, when they do science, can come together and do great things together. They put aside their sociological issues. We have many instances of that on our experiment and the other
large
experiment.
So you're talking Arab and Israeli,
yes.
Indian and Pakistani.
Yes, these many examples of this. And so and we come with the free exchange of ideas, collaboration, working together to solve big problems in basic science. And so that is one of the things I find most rewarding. I like to spend time there. I like to go and be a part of the science.
It's a great sociological experiment as well as a physics experiment.
And it's succeeding in both facets.
I was amused and pleased. And we actually had a university from Cairo that joined the experiment. And when they showed a picture of the group, it was dominantly female. And they were showing them working in the laboratories. The world is changing.
Chris New, when will you know if the Higgs boson has been found, that this particle that you're now examining is, in fact, what you were looking for?
We need about 6 months more worth of data to get some really important feedback. We're going to get that between now and February 2013. We'll analyze that data up through March in the spring of 2013, and that'll give us our next set of data on which to assess whether this particle that we've observed is consistent with the standard run-of-the-mill Higgs boson that we know and love, or if it's some slight variation on the theme. We're going to get that data here coming up. We're already analyzing the data that we need.
It could very well be that we see a Higgs boson, that's one of several Higgs bosons. It could very well be that the lightness, the light weight, if you want, the light mass of this Higgs boson points us toward the future experimentation that we ought to be doing. It's a very serendipitous discovery. Not only do we see it where it should be for a standard model Higgs, but it's of a mass that tells us the only way that that mass can be that low is that something else is out there for us to discover.
When you know more, will you come back and tell us about it?
Absolutely,
surely.
It might not be a complete story yet. Even in 6 months, we've got a lot of work to do.
It might not be a complete story in 500 years. So,
our guests, Christopher New and Brad Cox, both from the University of Virginia, both members of the High Energy Physics Group there, and both members of the team of scientists working on the CMS detector at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Tom.
And we have to get you back sooner than 2.5 years. It's such a thrill having you here. It's so good to see you back. Thanks. Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from Dan Easley. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. If you go to that page, you can find links to more information about the work both of our guests are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.